Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at cenovus.com.
Welcome to another Britflix.com podcast. My name's Stuart Wright, and today's guest is Paul Williams. Welcome to the show.
Hey, mate. Now Paul Williams, everyone will be like, who's he? The guy who wrote the thing, Bugsy Malone. Because I changed my name from Paul Williams.
Yeah.
I mean, Paul Andrew Williams is my full name.
Yeah.
And there was already the Paul Williams of Bugsy Malone music fame. So my short films were all by Paul Williams, and then when we did London to Brighton, it was like, actually, it should be Paul Andrew Williams.
Well, welcome to the show, and as you've already alluded to and suggested, we are talking about your movie from 2006, London to Brighton, which has made itself known on Amazon Prime, which prompted me to say hello to you in the internets. And here we are talking and looking at each other, which is kind of that feels almost like normal come 10 months into a pandemic.
I'm seeing, yeah. Well, we probably would be over a table at some if we were doing it.
Yeah, I'm now chomping at the bit now to be sat opposite somebody where they've got a microphone in their hand and I've got one in my hand and we talk. It's like, that would be amazing.
Yeah.
But we're not, so we're going to make the best of it we can. And we're going to talk about the writing and making of your film, London to Brighton.
Is that a girl here? Find out who she is.
Am I right in thinking that the starting point for the film is that the short film Royalty is where it comes from?
Yeah, no, I mean, what it came from was I'd already started, as I said, I used to be an actor, and I did a film that was set there, set around King's Cross, called A Kind of Hush.
Yeah.
About 97. And I remember doing the film, and we were playing homeless rent boys.
Yeah.
And it was all about abuse and stuff like that. But anyway, I just remember like looking at who was in it and then looking at the reality in King's Cross. And this is back in the day when it was shit.
Mm.
And thinking, well, that the film is not that. That is the reality of this King's Cross, and it's not the same picture that I'm looking at here.
Mm.
And it sort of made me think, you know, that's what I'm interested in the people who are involved in the reality of King's Cross.
Right, okay.
And anyway, years later, I made a couple of short films and music videos, and it was like, okay, I've got this idea, set over one night, and it's just about this girl, and she's got to make some money, and basically the story of Royalty. And we said we're going to do it properly, we're going to pay people properly. So we had 25 grand, and we were going to shoot over a week. And obviously, we were shooting on 16 mil, and we're going to do it like a proper production.
Mm.
That was when we got Wellington Films involved, and yeah, we set it up. But for me, it was all about the acting and rehearsing and characters, and we had auditions, and then once we cast these people who, apart from Lorraine and another one, Chloe, we literally just, that, you know, they're all unknown.
Mm.
And you know, we did about 5 days rehearsal for a short film, so we rehearsed as long as we shot it.
That's a long time, isn't it?
Yeah. And then we shot it over over a week in King's Cross, or over in nights. And from there, you know, that's sort of that's the thing that got me attention first of all. I got me an agent, and then, you know, it went to a lot of festivals and it got me. So that did well. And it was, I was, you know, obviously really still trying out working what to do and how to, I had no, you know, still, you know, what's the word? Finding out how you made shit. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. And that was it. And I never, ever thought about doing a story about that ever again. Right.
Okay.
So once that had been done, I just put it to bed, didn't think about it. And, you know, and it sort of did, you know, people thought it was very good anyway. People thought the film was good, which was, gave me the confidence to continue trying to do stuff, if you like.
Yeah.
And anyway, I was trying to get a film called The Cottage made. And for love nor money, with the film council, everything, we were all sort of, I couldn't get anywhere. No one had given me any money because I'd not made a feature film before. So I was completely, I wasn't trusted to do it. And anyway, after a while, I was so sick of not making something and not being believed to do it. I had this idea, just a brief, if you know the film, I had the scene in my head where Joanne and Kelly go to the paedophile's house and they walk in and it's, and I had that scene in my head just of these two people and I thought, actually, what if that was Kelly? From Royalty, the character from Royalty. And I said, okay, so then I sort of had a very rough idea in my head of what the story was. And then I literally was staying, living with my parents pretty much at the time.
Yeah.
And on Friday afternoon, I started writing. And then on Monday, I had like a 75-page script. And that was very close to what we ended up filming.
Was it made easier by the fact that You've already done this film where you showcased who Kelly was, and then having decided she's the woman that, one of the women that's there, did that give you a sense of setting and stuff because you had the character?
No, to be honest, not really. I mean, obviously, I used those two characters, Derek and Kelly. But to be honest, I'd never had no idea that that would be the case. So I just, it was more like the story just came from. And originally, I wrote the story in a linear form. So there was no flashbacks or anything like that. And then someone read it and gave me a bit of it and just, you know, why don't you start it there? I thought, okay, well, that's a good idea. And I swapped it round. And then, you know, I showed it to Lorraine, who played Kelly, and Johnny Harris. And I suddenly thought, right, that's it. I'm going to make it. And I plucked 60 grand out the air. Right. Because I'd made short films for 20 grand, 25 grand. And I thought, if you can do 3 weeks worth of short films, 60, I reckon we can shoot this film. And then I sent the script to Wellington Films, who made Royalty, and said, look, I want to make this film. I'm going to make it 60 grand. Do you want to do it? And they were thinking about it. They had to think about it. And then the guy who I was working with on the cottage, I was like, do you want to do it? And his words were, I'm on the dole. So might as well do this one for free. So basically, yeah, no, I went to a business angel who'd sort of helped, who was a friend's dad, who was an ex-stockbroker and very wealthy. And he'd given us a grand here and there to make short films and so on.
Yeah.
And I remember going to him and saying, he was going to the theatre and I met him at the National Theatre when he was with his wife. And I said, look, mate, I'm going to make a feature film. I need 60 grand. If you can get your rich mates to raise that money, 5 grand here, a grand here, whatever, then I will give them half the film. And he was like, all right. And he gave me a check for 300 quid, I think, at the time, which was basically to cover my rent.
Yeah.
And then I said to the producers, I said, right, we're going to make this on this date. And whether we've got 5 grand or 10 grand or 50 grand or whatever, we're going to make it then.
Wow. So it was like that classic, the thing we see now on lots of sort of guru things. You went, I'm self-actualizing it, and that's going to be what's going to take me forward to do it now, come what may.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, it was very much like, look, I genuinely think, you know, there's lots of people who, and I knew them at the time from short films, actually, you know, they would always be like, I've got this great idea. Mm. Got a great idea for a feature. I'm going to make that one day. And so people in the industry, or my peers at the time, who were, you know, on the same level as me, everyone just said it and everyone heard it and no one else ever thought anything of it.
Mm.
So the minute you say, we are making this bit of the film, and these are the dates we're making it, and suddenly it's a real entity. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And in a way, it's like once that avalanche starts coming down the hill, is going down the hill, and whatever it'll be at the bottom, you know, or whatever speed it picks, whatever, it's actually happening. So from there, it was right. No, we, you know, we made the thing of that. This is the budget. No one's getting paid a single penny. People get paid their train fare. And if you had to sign on, you could get time off to sign on. and we just went for it. And basically anyone who did it, the people, the crew and stuff like that, were pretty much all stepping up to a first time as a DP for a feature, first time as this, first time as that. So we were all incredibly green.
Just rewind it a second to that idea of you powering through that first draft and then getting some feedback on it. What while finalising that part of the process was the main storytelling challenges then? Once you'd done this like linear version and the suggestions were, you know, why not try this, that non-linear thing? How did that manifest itself as a kind of screenwriting challenge?
Well, I mean, I didn't consider myself a screenwriter.
Okay.
I just, you know, I don't, and still not now, still I don't have any formula or anything in terms of how you write.
Mm.
It's always just, that's why I mean, like, I struggle with the terminology of what a script would be in terms of genre and things like that, because I'm like, well, I've got this story, and do I like it? Do I believe it? And if someone's got an idea, and this person was really in development and was nothing to do with ever making it, but he just offered it as a suggestion. And, you know, we'd sort of been around the houses with various, you know, real funding bodies on the cottage and just wasn't getting anywhere. And so I was determined to say, look, I'm going to make it, and I don't want development notes, don't want anything like that. I want to see it. And if it works, it works. And if it doesn't, you know, that's whatever. But, and you know what? I think development can obviously provide some great notes and really make things work. But I also think they can just like shit your film up.
No, they can kill it. That's for certain. There's no doubt about it. You can end up pursuing perfection, which is never the friend of anything creative.
No, but also, you're only working on someone else's opinion, aren't you? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, no, yeah. Knows. You only need two contradictory opinions, don't you? And then suddenly you're in a stasis, aren't you, if they've got equal importance.
But also, I'm like, you know, I don't want to make, you know, I want to make my film. And so the agenda for me was to make my film. And with the best will in the world, everyone's got their own agenda.
If that was just basically you were making your film, and obviously the decisions you were taking were you were in control more than you ever thought you would have been before. So that decision to sort of move the story around gives us, and I should probably say, we said at the beginning, we are going to be giving spoilers, because I'm going to be asking specific questions about stuff in the film. So for people that have seen London to Brighton and want to know more, this is the podcast to turn up for. If you've not seen London to Brighton and you're enticed having listened to this already, then go find it on Prime Video and give it a watch, then come back. Because as a starting point, and this plays into a conversation we had before about TV shows, you throw us into the story in the opening sequence. I mean, we've got no idea what's going on, who these people are, and yet you're transfixed. And that's really a really powerful way. And it's not the kind of It's not the classic kind of, oh, it's a cold opening just to make sure you know what genre of movie you're in. This is like, the train's left the station. You better get on. You better get on and shut the door.
Well, obviously, that's in the edit as well. You get to the edit and go, that's how it should start. You know, I always think you write, you have a film that you write, you have a film that you shoot, and then you have a film that is edited.
Mm.
But the idea of coming into that toilet, which you shot on the first day, and us knowing, not having a fucking clue what's going on, but knowing that there's, you're just like, what is it? I've come back to the day of doing that day. Right. But you can see it on YouTube. There's like a 22-minute making of.
Mm. I mean, obviously, again, I don't need me to tell you. Obviously, you're right, but in terms of that things changes once you get into the edit. But even just watching it again last week, it was the sense of who's Derek? Is Derek dead? Is Derek the dead? Is he alive? I mean, none of that's clear. You're hearing names, and you're not sure who anybody is because they're not giving you're not giving us their names up front. And so you as an audience member are kind of thrown around as much as the principal characters are moving forward without really knowing where they're heading beyond we need to lie down, we need to lie low for 2 days.
Yeah, it's great, isn't it? I mean, I think for me that is, a lot of the time you get in development, people say, I was reading this bit and I didn't know who these people were. And I'm like, but you do know who they are when you find out in 5 pages. And they're like, yeah, fine, so we don't need to do anything to that. I'm like, so a lot of the time, it's like when you're watching the show with somebody and you might have seen it before and they want to know what's going to happen. But what happens to him in the future? I'm like, well, just watch it. And there's something about just watching it and seeing where it takes you.
I remember on the commentary for Reservoir Dogs, Tarantino was asked about non-linear storytelling. And he said, he described it as, he said, it's not non-linear. He said, this is just the order I've chosen to tell you the story in, which I thought was kind of a nice way of describing it.
Yeah, no, I think that's, he's right. And I think that, obviously he's right, he's Quentin Tarantino, but look, we played around with it in the edit when I'd written the script. It was very, very choppy. And then you, when you were working in the edit, you go, actually, it's too much because now I'm tension dipping and, so you need to sort of withhold that, you need to keep the energy and the tension up as much as possible. And if it means putting scenes in a longer consecutive run, and that's what you have to do.
So we've got this explosive introduction of Kelly and Joanne. And then there's this almost like reverent introduction of Stuart Allen, who's our principal kind of antagonist, although he's not the only antagonistic force in terms of how you might perceive the film. Derek being probably the more antagonistic overall. But having had all that energy thrown into a toilet, jumping on a train, et cetera, then suddenly we're sat, and it's like a portrait of Sam Spruill, isn't it?
Stuart, what's happening? Stuart, what's going on?
Fucking hell. Give me a drink.
It was always that idea of, like, what's he looking at? What's, I don't know, I mean, this is naive, because I didn't go to film school or anything. I just thought, I'm interested, I'm looking at him going, well, he's looking at something that's fucking pretty heavy.
You use that tool throughout the film, this idea of what are they seeing? You don't always let the audience in on it. You let the imagination do all the work for you, in a sense, or do the hard work. That if you'd have put it on camera, it wouldn't have been as effective. It's almost like wouldn't have been as powerful as what the audience.
I mean, you get, and also there are little bits of information. You know, he's going, you know, he's had a girl here, and you know, so that would then obviously help you think back to, you know, what the two girls are running away from.
Mm.
I just remember being in that house and obviously getting told off by everyone because we were going over for the 18th day running. We're getting blood on a carpet. What? No, God, can't do that.
Was that a house borrowed one, or was that a like a book or set?
Yeah, basically that house was the house of the business angel who was the one I met before, you know, met at the theatre, and who gave me their first bit of money. And basically he, his house was the bedroom, and another of the investors, the house was the downstairs. So we shot on two different days, two different houses. It was just bonkers, man. And also we didn't have a clue, man. We were just working out as we were going along.
It had been a while since I'd seen London to Brighton when I went back to watch it. And like the first time I really, it's like, I was paying, you know, full attention. And then suddenly Kelly's not got a black eye. And I'm like, where am I now? And we're walking into, you know, we're going into Derek's place. And it's like, oh, right. We're now going back on ourselves. And suddenly I was like, okay, we're.
And now, and I'm trying to think if actually I did make it. So if you know, you would like to think that it was a conscious decision, right? Yeah. To that the eye will be the tell.
Well, the cut from scenes made you feel like it was continuous until her eye came into the. Until it became a mid shot, as it.
I know, but you know, obviously, as soon as you see she's not got a black eye, it's either in the future or in the past.
Yeah, yeah. And then, like, you're like, okay, what's going on now? And suddenly, so we get this idea. So Kelly obviously is Lorraine Stanley, who was in Royalty, so that obviously made perfect sense in your casting. But obviously, the role of Joanne is the kind of the difficult part of the casting, given the subject matter of London to Brighton. So. What are your memories of casting the Joanne role and getting Georgia Groom for that role?
Well, we basically obviously had no money, so we weren't paying anyone. We weren't really paying the casting director, and the casting director, and obviously we're talking about needing to find a girl whose parents would allow them to be in a film that would. Be depicting what we showed, or what we inferred, right?
Indeed.
And you know, I went to look at what was it? I went to Oldham to look at a kid in a basically people just were throwing names, and then there was this workshop where I went to see called the Carlton TV workshop, where actually like Jack O'Connell and Georgia Groom. And Samantha Morton and people like that had all been a part of.
Right.
And I remember watching, you know, we were doing auditions and giving them improvisations and stuff like that. And there was, I don't know what there was, but there was something about Georgia Groom. Then we got a load of people to come down and do like a read through one-on-one. Georgia was just amazing. And she broke down and she was crying on spot. And I was like, what the fuck? This is insane. At this point, their mum had read the script and just thought it was a good part. You know, and Georgia hadn't done any acting before, certainly not anything on camera.
Blimey.
And it was just a laugh to her. And it was really good to be able to, you know, there was something very cool about directing someone who didn't really go too deep into whys and hows and just sort of was very instinctive about how she did it.
Was there any need to get her and Lorraine Stanley to form a relationship prior to shooting?
Well, we had read through and we had rehearsals. So we had rehearsals, and in those rehearsals, we were very much trying to do, what's it called? Improvs. So we basically did, we were improvising all the scenes that weren't there, that weren't in the film. And through that, and that was purely just so they had a sense of their character, but also so they got to fuck about with each other and sort of get things wrong and just, yeah, you're right, form some bond. And then what I always try to do, and it's much easier to do on a film, is have a get together before you start. So like a little rap party thing, but early on, but before. So everyone's got a pre-shoot party, just so everyone has got something that they can talk about on day one.
Because obviously, not obviously at all, but for anyone that's seen it, listening to this, the relationship, as much as it's a protective one, is a visceral one, isn't it, between Kelly and Joanne? Kelly doesn't know what she's doing, but she's doing it. And Joanne hasn't got a Scooby-Doo, what's happening at all in reality, but they both have the vivid memory of what they've run away from.
Does your mum and dad know you're begging?
How much you got?
Enough.
What, for a cup of coffee?
Piss off. Let's have one of them. What's the magic word?
Give me a fag, please.
How old are you?
15.
Fuck off. How old are you really?
12 this year. Have you got any money?
You just told me you had money, you fucking liar.
Who are you calling a fucking liar?
You know, is how, you know, one person who's culpable from her own circumstances is to blame, essentially, for the immediate predicament, but also, you know, the fact that she then, her mission is to save her. I think is really, yeah, it's really complicated, isn't it? But also, you know, I've got a 13-year-old boy, and however old and grown up people think, you know, 12-year-olds think they are, they're just kids.
Yeah. Yeah, the emotional intelligence, you can't bolt that on, can you?
No, you don't get that from, no, you don't. I think, but you know, you can be fooled by someone being cocky and brave and,
yeah.
But, and then, yeah, they're obviously still children.
The sort of full-on sort of grooming scene is really interesting in the sense of listening to the language of Derek, getting people to do what they can't possibly want to do voluntarily or not, is like sleight of hand. His language that you've given him.
For which bit? When he's with the girl at the beginning, or whether he's with...
Well, there's two. There's the you're the most beautiful girl I've ever seen. Now go in there and fuck me mates. As the kind of finish, he's like, what? Of which, as for the eagle-eyed viewer, they will spot your lovely face in that room as the door shuts. Yeah.
Well, I think, do you know what? I think in that scene, to give him, I'm sure that, because there's a scene very similar to that in Royalty. What I think is that I'm pretty sure that Johnny Harris came up with that thing of like giving her loads of compliments in the audition for Royalty.
Yeah.
And then it made its way into the film, and then that made it into the short, and then made its way into the feature.
Yeah, because there's the taxi scene in the short where he wants her to do something. Then it's a fairly, there's some similar ground in the diner scene, but obviously in the diner scene, you're talking to a 12-year-old kid with the same choice. And it's like, do you want some ice cream? And then it's like brilliant things that remind you that he's talking to a kid. Like, do you want some ice cream? And her face lights up. So we as the adults watching it are fully aware of the imminent danger and what this all does because of the earlier scene back at the apartment. And she just thinks, this guy's going to give me £100 to go and play with a guy for an hour. Because that's all.
Those are the things that you can... those are the things that you can understand. The thing is that there's bravado that gets you into trouble, and the naivety of being a child like that and seeing only the big money without, you know, just not questioning things because you don't understand. That's probably one of my favourite scenes in it.
Where's all your bedding?
I haven't got any.
Are you on the streets?
No. I have been, though. Shit, innit?
I'm battling being at home.
Hey, what's your name?
Joan.
Derek.
She's been out a couple of nights.
Where you been staying?
She's just asked me all that.
How old are you?
Nearly 12.
Do you want something else? Some ice cream or something?
Mate, ice cream.
But I think that's one of the magic things about the film, as harrowing it is an experience to watch, the brilliance of seeing Joanne's character be a fighter who's clearly got chutzpah and wants to fight a corner, but she is at crucial moments always reminding us, because of when it gets too much, that she is a child and children need adults to trust.
Yeah, well, I mean, she says to him, she says to Joanne, to Kelly in the car, will I have to kiss him?
Oh, God, oh, yeah.
You know. God. I mean, it's pretty dark, isn't it? And Kelly's like, yeah, probably. But it, because that, I would imagine that would be the kind of conversation that she might have. What have I got to do? You know, and also she's with Kelly, who she's formed a little bit more of a bond with. And can possibly be a little bit more vulnerable. Really.
Now, this is sort of flitting between the setup and the end. And it wasn't till rewatching it that I clocked the fact that when Stuart Allen gets Derek in the car to basically tell him what he needs him to do, I'm guessing in a way, Stuart's already decided what the fate of Derek is at that point, and obviously you signal that to us by the surprise move with the cutthroat razor before he gets him out of the car.
Who's the other girl?
Her name's Kelly. What's happened? What have they done?
I want those two girls.
I'll find them.
You better add. And then you're going to call me.
All right, I will.
Have you got my number?
No.
Get it off him. Find those two girls, and if I don't hear from you by this time tomorrow, you're a fucking dead man. Get out.
Yeah, I mean, I think that I don't, you know, look, the whole idea of the fact is that Sam's dad wasn't very nice and was not very nice to Sam's character. And basically, I think the idea of his dad being a paedophile, it probably feels so much revulsion that now is, you know, that's why he's going to kill Derek. That's why I think he, you know, and that's why you're right, it's in his head. And I think the thing is, it's just complicated in terms of his relationship with his father, that he wants to seek revenge and find out exactly what happened. But he also knows what's right and what's wrong.
Yeah, because he calls out Derek's character from the beginning of that conversation, doesn't he? He basically looks around where the locale is and says, these are your people, aren't they? This is you.
Yeah, scumbags.
Jumping to that, because that's weirdly that the scene in the car with Sam Shrell and Georgia is arguably that's probably my favourite scene in the film, because I get the feeling watching it, it's almost like Stuart Allen, the character, is 12 years old himself. Part of the anger and rage at his dad is in his failed attempt to say sorry to Joanne for having put her in that position.
I think there's just a mixture of everything of like why. I think it's on the one hand, knowing that he wanted someone to do that, you know, and it could, you know, and it's open to interpretation. It could be that she did it and he didn't do it. It could be, you're right, that he'd been abusing his own son, and what he got his son to do. There's so many different things of what it could be, and I think that obviously as an actor, Sam would want to know what it was.
Mm.
It was always to talk about the confusion of you want someone dead, and you've wanted them dead all, you know, for a very long time, but they're your father, and the bond that is there through the law of being father and son ever prevents you from really imagining that could happen, and then suddenly it does happen. It's just a head fuck, basically.
Mm. But it came together brilliantly, because you've seen this man who is the swan gliding on the lake, and you don't see his feet ever. And in that scene in the car is the first time you're seeing his feet go like Billy-O.
You know, again, just thinking about, you know, we've shot that. Obviously, we did night shoots at that point, and
yeah.
You know, this is that was towards the end of the film, and just being so exhausted. I'll never forget riding home or driving home with the sound guy with all the windows open, just doing whatever we could to stay awake while we were driving.
Where was that field?
It was one of the producer's mates owned the house and had land at the bottom, and let us use it. And obviously we didn't have loads of lights, so we were just lighting things from the car headlights and pretend car headlights. And oh, really? You know, you watch it and it's, you know, it's grainy and it's out of focus and probably just looks as dirty as it did, as it should do, I suppose.
No, it does. And what the lovely touch to that whole sequence in the build-up to it is the handing over of cash to Dave at the gate. Was that in the script, or was that something that you thought, oh, this is, I can add something else in?
Oh, what, they give money to the old man?
Yeah, he says, yeah, Dave, that's for you. And then they drive into the field, and obviously Derek and Chum are going.
Oh, right, yeah, do you know what? I thought about that on the day.
Because that was a real brilliant moment in a kind of big emotional moment that's going on.
But he owned that was the guy we were using his drive. And it was like, can you open the door for us? I think he had a limp.
Yeah, because he's got a walking stick, and then you've got this in the car. We're seeing this from Derek and Chum's point of view, and they're going, what's going on? Which is obviously what the audience are asking as well. It's bloody brilliant.
I just remember being in, and we were in the car. We were in the car with him, and the reason Chum was doing it was because Johnny couldn't drive. So I think that was one of the reasons why we had Chum in the script of Royalty.
Get out of town.
Johnny couldn't drive, and anyway, so I just remember being in the back with him as they were filming, and the ground was shit, and he just could not get up this hill no matter what, and they were just improvising for ages until he's like, mate, fuck it, let's leave it, man, you ain't gonna get up there, right? God, yeah.
Well, Johnny being in, obviously, Derek in Royalty and in London to Brighton, much like the Joanne character, but for different reasons, what you get with him is the yin and yang between the moments where he's the powerful one and the moments when he's the weak one. And it's like he doesn't know what fucking day it is.
Like all thick bullies.
Hmm.
You know. He's a bully, isn't he? And the thing about bullies is there's always going to be someone tougher and someone that bully is scared of, whether it's your dad or whether it's, you know, your older brother or your older brother's mates or someone. But he knows his place, really. And there are a couple of times with Johnny where I thought of lines on the day.
Hmm.
And he was just like, well, I'm not sure, man. Like, there's a scene when he's getting the gun originally and he's like, I love this flat.
Hmm.
He's looking at this flat, which is basically just a sort of normal flat, but it's just so far beyond it.
What else am I going to fire out of it? I want it on me in case Stuart Allen comes after me. Killing myself. Both of their stupid fucking heads getting me in this mess.
You should just give them to Alan.
Finish your coffee, I'm going back to bed. Make sure you bring it back.
I love this flat. Lucky cunt.
Well, it had serenity. It had, in terms of what we'd witnessed so far, that flat represented the first moment of almost serenity.
Well, you know, he's got a nice sofa, mugs, and he was just like, and I said,
the guy's wearing a clean bathrobe.
Yeah, and I was like, you know, so when he says, when he's gone, it's like, yeah, you fucking he's fucking nice out, you know. I had to really convince him to say it. And also, when gets asked for the gun, if you're stupid enough to bring a gun, don't let me see it. Give it here. And then he says, can I have it back? It's not mine.
Give it me back. It's not mine. I was like, that was one, again, a lovely little, it's those dip, those rises and falls of his character, which is so, it felt so real.
And he's just like, you know, it's like, it is and is. It's like, mate, I'm going to get in loads of shit. Just give it back at the end of whatever happens. Just the stupidity, you know.
So when you're driving home with the windows open, trying to stay awake. So how far into the shoot were you when you did that sequence?
We must have been near the end,
right?
I mean, we were shooting 6 days a week.
Yeah,
we were shooting. We were going over at least an hour to 2 hours a night. The food we were getting was, because we couldn't really afford it, with very small portions of food. Oh, man. But it was the most rewarding experience ever. So, you know, God, we were fucking way, I was just so tired. And just green.
Can you kind of almost like get into the headspace of just imagining that tired and going, oh, look, I'm not, thank Christ for that.
Well, just, the thing is, you're making a film and, back when you're not so, before you get cynical and bitter, right? You're always in a position where you're like, oh my God, we're making a film. What's great, isn't it? The first time you see someone fire a fake gun and you're like, no way. And it's, you know, and when, you know, for me, it was like seeing, I know it sounds wanky maybe, but like to see what I believe to be good acting and people saying my words and it being like, you know, I believe these are great performances. And it got to the point where, you know, obviously when people were doing the job, it was like, they were doing it for deferrals.
Mm.
And then when some of the people were like, you might actually make some money out of this. And you're like, you see people have actually got a bit of faith in it. That, you know, it feels, you feel like we're part of something, man, because there isn't a hierarchy. There was not really a hierarchy. We were all very much working together as a team. No one getting paid. Everyone eating the same food. No trailers. No nothing. Everyone literally on the same level, mucking in, trying to, you know, work their way out, work out what it is to be make a film. You know, and there was something about that that was quite special.
Now, this is...
None of us had made it. None of us were big and famous. None of us were, you know...
entitled to anything, in the sense of the discovery was everything about what you were doing, because obviously if you've never done it before, then everything's, it's like mini, it must be like adrenaline runs all the time. You're kind of, oh, there we are. Like you say, we're firing a gun. That performance was fantastic. They're saying my words.
Yeah, but also it's, you know, it's kind of, you're unaffected by the future of what your work could become, if you like. Mm. You are purely in the moment. There is no real baggage. So you're not in a situation where you're really having to prove yourself to anybody.
Mm.
Or you're not having to reboot your career. You're not having to do anything. You're purely doing something for the reasons of, you know, I really believe in what we're doing. I really believe in this and what we're all sort of going for.
That was a conversation I had last year with Mark Jenkin, who did Bait.
Where
he kind of got locked in this loop of not making films. And in the end, he just took very much like what you described yourself with this, is he then took control of it and went, we're going to make this film ourselves. And he went back to his 16 mil. He had a load of, out of date 16, black and white 16 mil, which was, he then hand processed it all, and so it all became him. He was in control of it, and but then obviously you're doing it, then, aren't you? You're not beholden to anyone, and then it becomes fun again, which is why you wanted to make films in the first place, because you thought it might be fun.
As I said, once you've been in the industry a while,
mm-hmm.
You're tainted. You're tainted by a lot of the shit that goes on, whereas when you first start. It's very innocent, I think, because you totally believe, you can believe anything. You can believe whatever might happen and so on. But it's only when you've been in the industry a while and suddenly there are people out there who might slag you off and slag your work off, and other people might love it and, you know, and things might not work.
Why in 2006 was 16 mil the right choice for shooting this movie? What would have been the option? What would have been the options in 2006?
Oh, it was either do it on. I think it was someone mentioned doing it on video, which is a no-no.
Yeah.
So the only option was doing it on 16 mil.
Yeah, because if you look at, say, I don't know, 28 Days Later, which is 2002 on Digivideo, isn't it? And while that is good for that film, It does give it a date, doesn't it? As a look and feel. Whereas,
but not only that, it's an aesthetic which, you know, in a way, it's with all respect to Danny Boyle, it's a lot easier to get away with if you're Danny Boyle and you've already made films.
True,
but not so, you know, that is, I love that movie a lot, and like Danny Boyle's work very much. So, but I think that when we did it,
yeah.
Also, we got a very good deal on the film. You know, we were very, like, and it added a discipline to what we were doing.
Well, I mean, obviously, the novelty now, looking back on it in 2021 eyes, is that there's a genuine organic quality to the screen.
Yeah, which you don't get now.
I mean, you can put filters on, but it's not film, is it?
No, it's not the same, for sure. You know, I still had no idea what cameras were, what the lenses were really at this point. I was still, you know, trying to, you know, I basically drew everything. I drew every shot. I had fucking ring binders full of each shot, but not each, like, camera position, but each edit.
Yeah.
And, you know, which I never used, ever.
Seriously?
But I did do it all. No, I never looked at it. And once I've done it, because the thing is you can never really do that unless it's a really technical scene, because you know, you can put positions in and stuff like that, but you want actors to be able to move around and not be, I need you here for this and that, you know, you want actors to be able to do the scene and then you work out how to film it.
How did you overcome the sort of, with the sort of limited resources you would have been playing with? How, and you talked about like use of car headlights and stuff. How did you manage to get so much out of 16 mil? What were some of the things that you and Chris Ross were doing to make it effective for you?
I mean, to be honest, it would all have been Chris Ross.
Okay.
So I didn't know. Or, you know, it was all handheld.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing is when you're making stuff, and I found this on the film we just did with Neil,
mm-hmm.
you can spend 2 hours doing something, you know, and taking your time and that, and then suddenly you've got to do another scene, which is a page and a half, and you've got 40 minutes. And you shoot that scene too. But you just shoot it quick.
Right.
And at the end of the day, what you need out of those scenes is the story. Now, whether you've shot 15 different sizes, it's irrelevant. Or whether you shoot one size, all you're really trying to do is to get that character to say the lines and for us to believe them. You know, editing can help, of course it can, but realistically, you just need to tell the story. It gets to the point where you get to, and you can try loads of stuff when you've got a bit of time, but then it gets to the point where you're very much like, we just need to tell the story now. So,
I spoke to Lucky McKee about making The Woman, and his DLP was, they were going through what they needed to do, and his DLP was going, well, we can do that, or what I can do for you is we can put the camera here, looking through these doors and windows or whatever, and people can come in out of frame and we'll get everything from one shot. And he's like, fantastic. And suddenly, it wasn't only effective, it was also making the film more interesting because they were rising to a challenge that was born out of time as much as it was about how creative can we be.
Yeah, it would have been... I think there's so many things involved in all the things you've done, which turn out to be very good for the film or the project, but which have completely born out of accident or
mm-hmm.
being forced into a situation. So you always go with those.
Can you cite an example for us of what we see on screen and what you remember it being like born out of a happy accident?
We only spent one day in Brighton, or 2 days, so one night in Brighton.
Seriously?
Yeah. And the first day we got there, where we shot them on the beach and paddling in the water and stuff like that, and it was a really sunny day. And the next day, it was absolutely shitting it down. So all the stuff I planned about how they did this and they walked around and it was all great on the beach and stuff like that at the ditch. And so I was rewriting it on the morning,
right,
trying to work out what to do. We were filming, and they were sat on the park bench outside. She's asking her to drink coffee out of a polystyrene cup.
Yeah.
And then basically, I said cut on the last shot. They were like, how long have you got left? And they were like, about 7 seconds. So I said, just let them... I said, right, you two, why don't you just let the cups go? And that second text, and we'll just film them going. Film them blowing in the wind for 7 seconds until the tape ran out, just because we could. And then a lot of people were very much, it's so indicative of them blowing in the wind and seeing where it takes them, whatever. But a lot of people talked about that.
Yeah, a lot. I think the famous story of that is Kurosawa's, well, the car factory was on the left and the airport was on the right and they couldn't be in shot, when people talking about why a choice of shot was made. But I suppose there's a subconscious at play, isn't there, that you're doing, as much as the happy accident only happens because of what opportunity you've created as much as anything else, isn't it? And obviously the actors have been working with you, so they've got an instinct for what might work as well at this point.
Well, I think, you know, luckily we were all so green that no one knew anything. I think they trusted me in terms of what I would say in terms of notes and so on. And that was great. But I think in terms of, you know, we were all just finding out what to do and working out how the best way of getting things done when we had no time and money. And, you know, it was all just such a learning thing.
Can we go to my granny's then?
Where is she?
Devon.
How am I going to get you to Devon?
Train. That's what I was going to use the £100 for, to get the train.
We'll sort something out. Right. Come on, let's have a fag. Bring my mate up, get round hers, get showered.
Logistically speaking, then, what represented the sort of biggest sort of practical challenge making London to Brighton?
Getting from one place to another, because we were moving locations continuously.
How disparate were your locations?
How split, did you say?
Yeah, how disparate, yeah.
Oh, all over the place. You know, people were travelling, you know, people were coming in to work on the tube, things like that. Hungry, mm-hmm. We were all very, very hungry. I mean, listen, we weren't fucking famine, but we were, you know, we were working hard and we were hungry. Also, things like not being able to get a train. I remember that Bluebell Railway, which we managed to get, which is like a, you know, someone just goes back and forth to show you a bit of something, it, like a tourist thing. And we managed to get it. But we could only do it in the day, so we had to keep it in the station, black it out, and use a light going past it, you know, just sort of swing the light through it. Just always trying to work out how we could do stuff. We only had one of each costume. One day, we lost one of them, you know, an item of clothes. It was mainly to do with time. Time was the biggest thing, because you're rushing so much. But there'd be things like, we can't shoot out this window, you know, like the house in Brighton, for example, is the same.
Yeah.
Is two doors away from the house where he gets the gun, which he says, fucking nice, love this flat.
Yeah.
So you've got them outside in both of those houses. But obviously, you can't show them that. So just the way we do that. But I remember, for example, you know, this is cutting corner at its finest, that Chris Ross, we were doing a tracking shot, a vehicle shot. So we were filming Sam's car driving. And the only way we could do it, because we couldn't afford camera trucks or anything like that, was one of the crew member had a Volvo Estate. Basically, we lifted the boot up and tied Chris to the back seat with his back against the back seat, staring out the back of the car with the camera. And that was how we secured him.
Gee whiz. You take the royalty shooting around King's Cross, but turning up, making a feature film, shooting around Waterloo and the like, what were the challenges there, and how much of that was...
Oh, no, we got permission. We,
I was going to say, so that was all done, properly, as it were?
Yeah, no, it was all done properly.
And that, but even when it's done properly, obviously, you know, there are still challenges, because it's still a wide open public space, as much as you've got permission to... How do you work around the practicalities of an urban environment that's very much never stops, which is obviously part of the character of your film?
Oh, we had security. We had a couple of security people for those moments.
Okay. So you essentially are like kind of holding off little bits of London that still want to get about while you get your shot and stuff.
Yeah.
Where was your world premiere, and what do you remember of that experience?
Okay, so can I just add something before that?
Sure, you can.
Basically, what happened was, we were trying to get money for another film, mm-hmm. right? And we started to show people like a selection of scenes. And from a selection of scenes, we started to get people going. Like, I took it into the Film Council, and they were like, and at this point, we didn't really have the money to finish it. Like, you know, for the post-production. And I remember showing them these scenes, and that wasn't why we were there. And they were like, where's the rest of this? What? And they were like, and so suddenly they saw these scenes and everyone was like, oh, we need to see this. How can we, what, you know, we want to get involved. Da, da, da.
Oh, wow.
And so I'm, you know, at that point I'm like, fucking hell, man, either it's really good, I've got a massive crisis, in, you know, imposter syndrome, you know, but suddenly you're like, it's fucking, yeah. And then we started to hear people really like, then there was a bit of a bidding war. And at this point, you know, not a massive bidding war, but like a lot of people wanted to be the distributors and stuff like that. So it was just all so weird. And then it got into the Edinburgh Film Festival, which for me was like, I didn't know anything about festivals, so I wasn't really aware of any of it. What we, you know, we were all planning to go down, and basically I'd heard, it was in the paper, Wendy I did a story on, who was doing a story on the festival. And in this story, she said, I've just seen a Sean Connery flipping out. He watched this film and just was saying how amazing it was. And so it's like, okay, so there was beginning to get a bit of a buzz about it. And anyway, we went to the festival and there was a, and we had the first screening that night. And I remember a guy called Richard Jobson was doing the Q&A.
Mm-hmm.
And we started to see the odd review coming in. And people were like, it's fucking amazing. And I was like, what? And it started to feel a bit, you know, that to me was very weird. And I remember there was someone saw Peter Bradshaw going into the screening. Who's the critic for The Guardian.
Hmm.
And they were like, fuck, man, oh, he's going in, he's really tough. And then that night I saw someone introduce me to him. Someone said, oh, you got to go meet Peter Bradshaw, he loves the film. And then Peter Bradshaw was like, I fucking love your film, it's so amazing. And then now I got introduced to Sean Connery, who was like, your film is so amazing. I just couldn't really believe it, you know? And what's weird is, and people, you know, in terms of like five stars and things like that, you know, when people get five stars from a magazine or whatever, you know, I can't, our film got so many five stars from the major outlets, you know, the major print news and so on. But it was one of the best reviewed films in recent times in terms of like 41 stars out of 45. And in a way, as soon as that happened, I knew I would not be able to achieve that again. So it was almost like I looked at it as my career was just going downhill from this point onwards.
You've made Never Mind the Bollocks, Here Comes the Sex Pistols.
I just was like, it's not going to work, is it? Because I'm not going to be able to achieve that again. So it really sent me on a fucking, complete imposter.
I'm glad you were able to share that with us, because I think a lot of people would perceive success and praise as being there's a moment where you jump on everyone's shoulders and they toss you around like you're a
no. I literally was like, I remember reading, I can't remember, we got five stars in one of the papers, and I remember speaking to the guy about it, the reviewer, about, you know, he did an interview with me, and I said, when I read that review, I started crying, because,
oh, wow,
I was like, I'm not ever going to, I can't, this is unsustainable, you know. That's how I felt, because the thing is, I've not had any training, I've not had any, you know, I basically would always perceive myself as someone who was fairly lazy and not focused. And yet suddenly we'd managed to achieve this thing. And I found it would be, what's the word? I used to think it, well, I thought it was, I couldn't take credit for it.
So when you're reading Bradshaw, right, Williams' film is 120 degree proof filler with storytelling nous and technical flair. You're thinking, well, I'll never do that again. No, thanks very much. That's brilliant news.
Yeah.
Amazing.
I was thinking, I don't even know how the fuck I did it. I don't know how I did it, so how can I do that again? Thinking I just didn't deserve to be there. My own issues, this is. But just literally thinking, I just felt uncomfortable about it all. In a way it's sad because, you know, obviously I'd reached it was quite unheard of for that to happen, because literally I'd come out of nowhere, you know, and the film had come out of nowhere, and it got, you know, and it all, you know, for one, without trying to be, you know, I don't mean this in a sort of like blow my own trumpet way, but it sort of launched, it sort of invented a kind of low budget, micro budget way of making films a bit, because after that, lots of films were made in that way. People felt that it was, you could do it. People felt you could make a film with no money if you really believed in it, you know.
Yeah, right. Yeah, because it kids, because the mid early noughties became this, almost like the badge was, how little did you make it for?
I look, you know, obviously thinking back now about all the different things that happened, what a fantastic experience. And, you know, life-changing film, complete life-changing moment, man.
Mm.
And I wish I could go back to the innocence of that time, of being green and having everything that happens to you be a first. First time you go to a festival and you realise people give it pain for you, you're like, what? Yeah. Just odd. Agents fucking fawning over me into Toronto. You know. Just, but also are aware that it's all bollocks. You know. I look back at that film and I haven't seen it for a while. I remember last time I watched some of it, I was like, fucking hell, this is bad.
You never did.
I did think that some of the dialogue was wrong, and yeah.
Well, I'm glad I got to have this conversation with you about it. It is a nailed on sort of, is a classic in his own right. It's
I know, and that's, you know, and that's, and I've got the poster up in my room, and people still talk about it. People still say I love that film. I'm like, mate, I've made fuckloads since then. But the fact that, you know, we made a film that changed a lot of people's lives in terms of who worked on it.
Mm.
And, you know, and I also know that, you know, people were doing it in A-level, people were doing it in film studies and so on. And, you know, again, without being all like, I am this, I know for a fact it made a lot of people think they could make a film. That could be a bad thing or a good thing, but yeah, I know that's what happened.
I think that's a good thing. Being from a kind of working class area, when you see a film that lives like next door and behind the curtains, and it could be part of the real world, and yet it still has the heightened energy of a movie.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it does have that, and you had people talking about it, like Paul Greengrass coming up to me going, "I loved your movie," and it was odd, you know, but. The thing was, it was just a moment, really, and it just made me think. Actually, maybe I'm not fucking shit at everything.
I'm pretty sure you're not. One question I've always wanted to ask you ever since I first saw the film when it came out, and I feel quite privileged now because I'm sat here talking to you. Is no matter how many times I watch it, I'm still wanting Kelly to have a happy ending. Now, I think. Quite possibly she's got a happy ending in the sense that she gets to survive another day.
No, she goes out and just carries on.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. She survives another day. That's her happy story, isn't it? Her happy ending is just surviving another day. And that would have been wrong any other way.
I think, to be honest, you know, once she's taken Joanne to that place and she comes back, I think the only good thing is that she doesn't have Derek to deal with.
Yeah.
That's probably it. And you know what? We shot an alternate ending where she got into a car and drove off and threw the teddy out the window. But I think that it was also, when you leave it open like that, it's like what people can make up their own mind of what they think.
Yeah, yeah, no. I think it's just that great thing of when a film's got you as much as it has, you're no longer watching a film. I'm watching Kelly, and I'm thinking, I want Kelly to be happy now. You know, which is kind of pathetic given how many films I've watched, but it's testimony to what happens when you watch your movie.
Yeah, well, that's great. Thanks, man. You know, I think the fact that people liked it was just great, you know, and I met my wife that way, you know, from doing, taking it to show at a drama school. You know, how weird is that?
That's amazing. Well, look, sir, I've taken up enough of your time and I'm very grateful.
Mate, I'd talk about it, but, you know, I haven't really talked about it for this long for a very, very long, yeah, I haven't talked about it for a long time.
No, it's been great. And I mean, I'm, you know, I always think it's always a privileged thing for me to do, to get a chance to look under the hood of a film. And certainly one I enjoyed as much as yours. So it just gives me to say thank you very much for giving us your time on the Britflix podcast.
Oh, mate, you're a legend. Thank you very much.
America, we are endowed by our Creator with certain unalienable rights, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. By honoring your sacred vocation of nursing, you impact your family, your friends, and your community. At Grand Canyon University, our online RN to BSN, MSN, or DNP degree programs allow you to balance online coursework with local in-person clinical, practicum, or immersion hours. Find your purpose at GCU. Private, Christian, affordable. Visit gcu.edu.